Words matter. Everyone's had the experience of leaving a conversation feeling frustrated, feeling convinced the other person didn't understand a word of what they said, or that they didn't understand a word of what the other person had said to them. Whether it's a bad meeting with a coworker or an argument with a spouse, ineffective or negative communication may lead to more than just a bad day. There are two researchers, one from Loyola Marymount and another from Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, who have been researching the effect and the power of words to actually shape our brains at different stages of our lives. And their book argues that our minds are hardwired to respond favorably to certain types of speech and negatively to other types of speech, starting in childhood. Humans' brains are molded by the types of words they hear. And in this day, seems like we have more words than ever. With laptops and tablets and smartphones and Apple Watches, words are abounding. Social media era runneth over with tweets and posts and blogs and diatribes of all kinds. And it would be hypocritical of me, one who posts on social media every day, and one who gets a 20-minute block of time that is quite public every week. It'd be hypocritical of me to try to argue that this is necessarily a bad thing. Words are just fine. But words do matter, don't they? The notion that we can just unleash them without consequence, without fear, without retribution, we know this to be patently false, of course. Little kids say things, as I've pointed out to you already, and when their little friends say to them, "Take that back," they do, and things seem to move on. But as we've mentioned before, adults learn eventually that words can't be taken back. Words between strangers, words from one in authority, words from a spouse or a parent or a child, they do last. Words can build up or tear down. Words can support or crumble life. They can found a strong and lasting new possibility or kill off any hope that was left. Words can soothe or upset. They can negotiate or separate. Words draw us closer and words create distance, don't they? Pop Christianity went through a time where it was in vogue to tell someone that you had something to share with them in love. Do you remember that? But then most of us learned that if somebody ever actually came up to us and said that, we'd better duck. Words carry a lot of power. And the reality is, when someone says something to us, we get to decide if it was loving or not, don't we? And so do they if we speak. Notice that in James we hear a caution about that. Peggy read it just a few minutes ago. If any think they are religious and do not bridle their tongues but deceive their hearts, their religion is worthless. The tongue is a powerful little machine. Its capability is great. We talk for a lot of reasons. In this age, the lines seem to get blurred at times. Entertainment, which is not in and of itself a bad thing at all, is often at the heart of our electronic world. Productivity also is. But in actual conversations, live face-to-face interactions, the same old purposes are usually at work. We talk in order to manage others, to pass along or trade information, to create expectations or to lessen expectations. We talk in order to manipulate or to direct others, to build closeness, love, and a familiar spirit with each other. We move others toward us with words, and we push others away from us with words. And sometimes we speak in order to deceive. Some have a curious relationship with truth, and at the darkest heart of it all, each of us, in reality, is only a sentence away from telling someone an untruth. Some of our best voices have tried to capture the nature of truth versus untruth. In his profound simplicity, Mark Twain once said, "If you tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything." Walter Scott said, "Oh, what a tangled web we weave when we first practice to deceive." I worried all weekend that I was going to go Elmer Fudd right there. Our benediction that is guiding the outline, the Chuck Bug benediction, that is the guiding outline for this sermon series, reminds us today to speak truthfully. And in Exodus chapter 20, verse 16, you just heard one of the Ten Commandments a few minutes ago say simply, "You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor." And this was not a suggestion. Humans have taken God's commandments and done with them what people are wont to do. We distort them, we legalize them, and make them into a system of measures against which we point fingers at one another when someone decides they want to sin differently than we like to. But these were more than mere suggestions. These were a code, but a code given by God who wanted all of creation to live together more healthfully, in peace, in harmony. The Ten Commandments are strong and necessary. They are God's expectations. Fall short of them and it is sin. But importantly, I believe that their intent shows us the very best of who God is. So when we hear that you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor, that is the way we should live. When Jesus said that we should not take oaths, but instead let our yes be yes and let our no be no, that was the best way to live, the healthy way. Our word is expected to be good, true. On that, there's no equivocation. Speak truthfully. Football recruits these days break their commitments and leave schools hanging at the last minute and casually explain that back when they committed, it was actually a soft commitment as opposed to a firm commitment that they were making. Of course, they've been taught to do this by coaches who promise them they're going to get to play early, only to bring them in knowing they're going to languish on the bench for a while. Or by coaches who promise them they're going to stay there to coach them through their college career, but as soon as the kid signs on the dotted line, jumps at the next offer that was bigger and better. People talk about shades of truth, versions of truth, and the hard reality for us is that the Bible affirms the truth only has one version, and that our words have tremendous power that can be used for good or for harm, but our word is only as good as our living up to it or the intent behind it. Now, why is that a hard reality? Because once we set that high bar, that lofty standard, once we take seriously God's greatest hopes for us on this matter, then we ourselves have to live up to it. Speak truthfully. But it's not just about the truth of what we say, is it? If any think they are religious and do not bridle their tongues but deceive their hearts, their religion is worthless. You can brutalize someone with facts, can't you? You can beat someone up with a smug presentation of truth, including gospel truth. You can destroy a relationship by being so utterly, bluntly right. And Christ expanded on our ability to understand the Ten Commandments with the young lawyer when he pulled forward the ancient Hebrew Shema that said, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength." And then he quickly added, "And the second great commandment is much like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself." And when we apply that standard to speaking truthfully, then I hope we speak more carefully. As I work with couples, one of the things that we focus on is communication. So let me take you inside my study just for a few minutes and let you be privy to something that I've done with literally hundreds of couples over the years in private, multi-session, premarital work or marriage enrichment work for veteran couples. When we talk about communication, I run them through this list of practical reasons that we speak, much like I've already mentioned just today. But then I point out to them that not all conversations operate on the same level of risk and intimacy. So let's look at the couple for a second. If a spouse says to the other, "Hey, we're out of milk. As you pass by Food Lion today on your way back home, would you mind stopping in and getting a gallon?" And then at the end of the day, they meet up back at home, and the same spouse says to the other, "Did you remember by any chance to stop by Food Lion and get the milk?" And the other spouse says, "I sure did. It's in the refrigerator." That's good communication. It's not very risky. It's not very intimate. It's information. It's the kind of conversations we've got to have to run a household. It's necessary, but it's not very deep, is it? But if that same couple is on the way home from a movie, and one of them says to the other, "Hey, what did you think of the movie we just saw?" And the other one says, "It wasn't really my thing. I didn't get much out of that." And the other one says, "You didn't? I could have done without the gratuitous violence, but I think I was picking up on some subplots of some messianic undertones." We don't have that conversation in the car on the way back from movies either, by the way. But if we did, that's a more intimate communication, isn't it? It's now risking ideas and opinions. It's sharing what you think and laying them vulnerable to the other person to react to. That's a deeper level of communication. Now, if another couple is on their way home from the annual family Christmas gathering, and they're in the car riding along, and the husband says to the wife, "I wasn't eavesdropping earlier, but I heard my mom ask you a question, and you were really short with her. It kind of hurt my feelings that you were that ugly to my mom. What was that all about?" Now we've gone real deep, haven't we? Now that's an intimate, risky conversation, isn't it? It could go one of two ways. The wife could say, "I can't believe you just said that to me. You always take your mother's side on these things. When are you going to begin to want to stand up for me? Do you know what she asked me?" That's one way the conversation could go. But it could go another way, couldn't it? That same person could say, "She did catch me a little off guard with the question she asked. I just wasn't expecting that. But you know, you're right. And I'm sorry. I should have taken that more in stride. What if when we get home, I go in the other room? I want to call your mom and apologize. How would that be?" See, that's two different endings to the same conversation. Both of them risky and intimate and honest. One of them does harm to the relationship, and the other one communicates that they've listened to and respected each other and works toward a solution. Words matter, don't they? And they carry tremendous power. If we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, James said, we guide their whole bodies. Or look at ships. Though they are so large that it takes strong winds to drive them, yet they are guided by a very small rudder. How great a forest is set ablaze by a small fire. And you've noticed that Genesis suggests that God spoke creation into being. And no doubt you've noticed that as John's gospel unfolds in the New Testament, John doesn't have the birth of a baby. There are no shepherds, no angels, no sheep out in the field. John simply begins to tell us that the Word became flesh. Words are a big deal. And speaking truthfully, we know as adults, is only the starting place. When we speak, it's filled with powerful possibilities for good or for harm. And it's important for us to notice, I think, why Moses and the people were given the Ten Commandments in the first place. If you just hear the list of them or read one of them as we did this morning, they sound very much directed at the individual. They sound very specific about possibilities that we could do and might, should, or should not do. But taken in their context, if you go back and take a look at Exodus chapter 20, these were given to us, these 10, actually to protect the health of the community that had already been founded. The original point of this law was no doubt to regulate false testimony in legal proceedings or in other community settings of judgment. But join it with Deuteronomy, Leviticus, Joshua, and even the prophecy of Hosea, for instance, as they all expand on this simple commandment, taking into account any communication that was deceptive, slanderous, idle, or empty. Eventually, this even included gossip or rumor because they could damage the reputation or the esteem of the target. And then Jesus came along and took this another step further in Matthew, cautioning in two ways. He told us to not swear falsely by making vows that we were doomed to break or that were deceptive. And he told us to keep the promises that we do make. Exodus, Deuteronomy, Leviticus, Matthew. Why all this talk about talk? Because the health of the community matters. Because people's lives other than your own, my own, matter. Because so many of our justice, economic, and civic systems and family systems depend on truthfulness as the base layer upon which all other nuances are built. Some believe that the Ten Commandments do not strictly have a prohibition against lying. That this one commandment is so strongly and so obviously worded in legalese that its context is the court system. J. Edgar Park, in his commentary on Exodus, though, says that some ancients actually admired the use of falsehoods as true art. That truth-telling, if we're being honest, has never really been an endearing value. In fact, the early books of the Old Testament present a few tales where lying was indeed elevated to have its masterpieces. Think the book of Judges, which we'll study in a few months. Think of Laban, who tricked the great deceiver Jacob into an extended period of working for him so that Jacob could have the hand of his intended. So perhaps because of people who take rules or laws and immediately start to probe around the edges for loopholes, we have Jesus' explanation and expansion and those of James and Paul who applied this commandment more to where we all live. They understood the consequences of the unbridled tongue. They also knew far more powerfully the potential in healthy relationships or churches or communities where trust had been forged. Franklin Baptist Church's history speaks to the importance of trust. Our very polity, identity, mission, and ministry footprints have been forged by generations who trusted each other. And still today, our ability to be church with each other is only as good as our truthfulness and integrity with each other is strong. We do things the way we do because we trust each other. This is a fellowship that has grown strong and a people who like to see each other in part because you believe in one another. And even now, a premium here is in maintaining that trust and integrity as we move forward. If we can depend that what we hear is loving and truthful, we have a bright future. If we can count on the notion that we have each other's goodwill at heart, along with God's greatest hopes, then we have a bright future. Earlier, I mentioned my work with couples. The subset of that, which I've enjoyed offering to veteran couples over the years, is called marriage tune-ups. Now, these are offered to couples who've been married at least 5 years. And I began to notice after several years of doing these marriage tune-ups that these veteran couples had a theme that often popped up in their relationships, which was, by the way, very different from some of the themes that pop up with premarital couples. What I noticed with these veteran couples was that they had long since moved on from the mostly recreational mode of dating. They were now trying to live further into the pledge they had made once upon a time to be roommates for life. They knew each other. Really knew each other, these couples that I worked with. And I began to notice over the years that competitiveness was a constant. Most of these weren't really marriages in any measurable trouble at all. More likely, it was couples who were doing okay but couldn't quite put their finger on why things didn't feel quite as loving and quite as fun as they used to. Life had changed them in a lot of ways, and a lot of things that were in their control and beyond their control had reshaped them. And now things just didn't quite feel the same. It played out in a million ways, but competitiveness, I noticed, had edged ahead where once the dating couples and the engaged couples had had a team approach. 1,000 little lies, deceits, fudges, shortcuts, and agendas had played through. And whatever it took to get what they wanted or needed, and their relationships had paid the price. Still don't know what all this adds up to. Speak truthfully. Not bluntly. No one likes that, but truthfully. Since biblical times, this has been the stuff of community and relationship that works. This has been the stuff we can rely on. This is the quality that, rather than breaking us down, moves us forward. So let me implore us all by reminding you, as you are going, speak truthfully. We join our voices just now in a hymn that is printed in your worship bulletin, number 33, asking God to shape who we are and what we are. And so, in just a moment, if you have a decision that needs to be presented down front, I'm going to be waiting for you. If you'd like to join your life with the life of this great congregation, I'll be here. Otherwise, stand and respond where you are. Hymn number 33, Guide Me, O Thou Great Jehovah.